Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comment. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Greetings and salutations, everyone. We have another great show in store for you today. So let's take a look at what's on tap. The controversy surrounding University of Texas head coach Charlie Strong. We also explore the new guidance released by the U.S. Departments of Education and Justice on school discipline. And we do a segment I'm calling The Shades of Black. It's really an extension of the conversation that Oprah had on her in one of her life class called Colorism, and much more. So without further ado, let's get started. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And joining me in the studio is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises. You can also follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJema. That's AskJema. I introduce the some and present the others, no other than Jema Hill Cook. Jema, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. First up, let's talk about the controversy surrounding University of Texas head coach Charlie Strong. Now, of course, there has been a lot of coverage on this issue, and I want to kind of recap, if you will, and to kind of give a little background to the listening audience in case they haven't heard any of the content or may not have been privy enough to kind of understand what's going on. And basically, there's a what I'm calling the $100 million man and booster Red McCombs made some interesting comments regarding Texas's decision to hire coach Charlie Strong to be the head coach of the University of Texas. Now, McCombs called the decision a kick in the face. He said, "I think the whole thing is a bit sideways," he said during the selection process, during an interview with ESPN in San Antonio. "I don't have any doubt," he says, that Charlie is a fine coach. I think he would make a great position coach, maybe a coordinator, but I don't believe he belongs at what he should be one of the three most powerful university programs in the world right now at University of Texas, Austin. I don't think it adds up. Now, so before we get into the discussion, I really want you to take a listen to a discussion between a couple of people. One, Wilbon had, and the other with Skip and Stephen A. Smith. I think it really puts this in perspective because in a lot of ways, people said his comments meant one thing, and in a lot of ways, people said his comments meant another. And so I want to kind of get you what Skip is calling a balanced view of this particular situation. And Gene, then I want you, along with our listening audience, to respond to basically what happened over the past couple of days. And then we'll get into his apology and put that in perspective first. But first, let's take a look at what Skip said in a discussion between him and Stephen A. Smith. Let's get your perspective on that. Take a listen.
Your discomfort is warranted. That's why I started off saying, who knows what was really behind these remarks? I don't know, you don't know.
Right.
But you can read between these lines.
Sure.
But I'm going to, for balance, I'm going to hit you with this.
Sure.
As you evaluated Teddy Bridgewater's season this year, I don't know how many times you brought up
schedule.
The weakness of schedule that
right.
Louisville played.
Right.
Okay, when Red McCombs would now look at it, we hired this guy? Who is this guy? And he looks at it, he would probably think about weakness of schedule. Remember, let me put this in some perspective.
Okay.
I grew up in Oklahoma hating the University of Texas. It's our arch rival. I despise them. I despise the Texas arrogance because no group of fans is more arrogant than the Texas fans. This, you know, like this is what we do in Oklahoma.
Right.
Okay? This is Texas arrogance at its peak here because he's just saying, who the heck is this guy? Well, he could have been our coordinator, maybe.
No,
he's talking about the Texas concept.
They're very arrogant comments.
Extreme
Skip.
Arrogant.
Very
that's
arrogant.
Who they are.
Skip, Kerry.
Well, at least that's who they used to be because they don't have
they don't
much
have
to,
that
to brag
anymore.
About.
They can't
Skip.
Be that arrogant.
No. That's not cutting it. And here is why. That's all he had to say.
Exactly. He could have left
Charlie
it there.
Strong.
Mm-hmm.
I respect the job that the man has done. But I don't consider Louisville a big-time program because look at this schedule. Who did you beat? It is not complicated for an astute businessman with his accomplishments.
He did say he's a fine. Didn't he say he's
listen,
a fine
listen,
coach?
Yeah. Well, what I'm trying to say to you, you're a fine coach. But I think he would make a great position coach. So in other words, you're saying that now, mind you, when you sit there, think about what you said, Skip. You said he meant Texas. Well, why couldn't he have said, I mean here, at Texas? Think about this. What
hey,
I'm trying to say
is... he's in his late 80s.
Okay,
so you're asking
which
for
is
it.
Why... Which, all right, well, listen. If you are lucid and cogent and articulate enough to say the stuff that you said,
mm-hmm.
it shouldn't be too much to ask you to okay. say what I'm suggesting as well.
Okay, so Jamie, you heard the story. You heard the conversation between Skip and Stephen A. Smith. And so I basically have two questions. One, do you think this is arrogance, as Skip put it?
Well, the short answer to that is yes. Yes, I do think it's arrogance. I also think it's privilege, white privilege. I mean, you know, he's an 80-some-year-old white man who is given the University of Texas billions of dollars, and he feels as though he has latitude to say whatever he wants to say and, you know, to damn be with whoever, however you feel about it. That's just, yeah. So, yeah, I think it was arrogant. And you're talking about a Texas program that hasn't been dominant, you know, for a while now. It's not like they've been in a championship, even the Big 12 championship in the last couple of years. So, you know, they ride off of tradition and past accomplishments, but they haven't done nothing recently. And so, yeah, it was arrogance. And I'm not real sure where he even gets put in Texas in the top three schools in the country. I haven't figured that out yet either. Maybe he's talking about facility-wise and the fact that they have the Longhorn Network and those sorts of things. But I, and I could be biased since I am a University of Oklahoma alumni, I could be a little bit biased towards this, but I'm not impressed with Texas' program. So, Yeah, I think it is arrogant. But it's arrogance because he put the money up there to be able to be arrogant.
Okay. So let's go to the phone lines now. Let's see what the listening audience out there are saying with respect to this particular situation. Hello, caller 7474. Give us your name.
Hey, what's up, man?
Absolutely.
Oh, Greg, call for Baltimore. Greg, I'm calling for Silver Springs, Maryland.
Hey, Greg, so what's your perspective?
I'm a black man, and the lady, Texas is the number one revenue school in America, and then this Alabama's number two. Texas is number one. I don't know if she knew that, but it is actually number one. But as a black man,
you're talking strictly dollars, all right? You're talking strictly dollars. When you talk about programs, you're going to put that in perspective.
Dollars,
you're talking dollars, right? Not championships, not wins, not bowl victories, but you're saying in terms of dollars.
Dollars, okay. But I would say Texas is one of the top five schools in America.
Okay.
I actually would say that. They are one of the top five. I think USC, Alabama, Michigan, Ohio State. I don't know. I would say Texas is top five. I would say it. Yeah, I would say it. They are.
Okay.
You know, as a black man, I heard the comments that dude said about the coach, and I had to stand back from it because I'm a big fan, and I actually did criticize Lane Kiffin for a long time, and I've criticized other white coaches. I think we make mistakes as black men. I always think it's racial. Maybe he honestly didn't think dude was qualified to be a head coach. Because I had never heard of Charlie Strong. All I'm saying is this. Maybe this guy, Mick McCombs, had a valid point. It had nothing to do with race. Maybe he was looking at Charlie Strong objectively and he said, this man maybe is not qualified. He's not high enough profile to be coaching Texas. And I would say maybe I have to agree a little bit with that, to be honest.
Okay, I think that's a fair assessment. But what do you think about the situation with respect to African-Americans and coaches across the NCAA? Not just in football, but basketball and other sports as well. We're talking strictly football here, but the representation on the field is certainly not representation on the sidelines.
It's not. Because you look at the field, at least 60-70% of the players are black, and then you don't have a lot of black, like the SEC. I don't think they got one black head coach in the SEC. And I think he came in with Texas A&M, and they never hired a black head coach in the SEC.
Right.
And never.
But
70% of the players are probably black. Yeah, go ahead.
But you do see the success that A&M is having now with an African-American coach. And so why can't that be extended to the University of Texas now that they have an African-American coach?
Because it takes time to become a head coach, man, because you got to – people think you just hire a head coach. You really don't. The coach has to have his staff with him, too, in place. Like, when you hire a coach, he brings his staff. He has to be able to recruit. You have to be sort of a salesman, too, when you're out here, recruiting these kids. You have to talk to the boosters. You have to raise revenue. It isn't just coaching, man. And I think a lot of these old-school institutions don't feel that African-Americans can talk to these racists. I'm saying they're racist, but a lot of these old money, white people boosters, they have to be comfortable with the head coach, and I think that plays a part of it. It's just my honest assessment. Yeah.
So you do believe then that there is some bias with respect to head coaches not being on the sideline, and so you think, and I'm not putting words in your mouth here, but my question is, do you think that McCombs had any of that in his comments? Knowing what you just,
said,
I think any of that was basically kind of projected in his particular statement.
No. You know what? I think McCombs had a valid point. I think he honestly doesn't believe this man is high enough profile to coach Texas. He wanted somebody higher profile. He wanted a big-name coach. That's what I think. It is what it is. And I don't think Charlie Strong is a high enough profile name. I had never heard of the man. That I didn't know much about him, and I actually have to give McCombs the benefit of the doubt. I think this is a separate issue. He didn't think the man was big enough stature to coach the University of Texas, and I would say I would agree. To be honest, I really would agree.
Okay, that's fair.
I mean, it's fair enough. I mean, man, when I was probably about 15 years old, you know, my father told me something. Cause my father's from the Deep South. He grew up in Georgia, you know, back in the old days. And he said, he told me something. He says, look, man, he said, it ain't always racism involved with these white folks. Sometimes they're just buttholes, you know. He just told me that. And I always keep that in the back of my mind. This man, maybe he just, you have to take him at face value. It may not be what we think it is. He honestly didn't think this man was qualified. Maybe he's not.
Okay, I think that's fair. So I want you to take a minute, and I want you to stay with me here for a second, because I think what you're saying is a very good perspective on this. But I want you to take a listen at what Wilbon had to say in an interview, and I want you to pay close attention to the guy's record, right? And so take a listen. Let me get you to comment. Gima, you too. Take a listen to this.
All right. Hey, there's no planes flying out here. Wake up. Do you like the fit of Charlie Strong in Texas? I don't know. I don't know if I like the fit of Charlie Strong. Charlie Strong's got quite a resume, Tony. First as an assistant coach down in Florida, then as a head coach at Louisville. I will tell you, though, more important to me, this is a significant hire. It's an important hire. I don't know if it's a successful hire yet, but for the University of Texas to hire a black head coach shocked the hell out of me. I'm not sure I could have been more shocked if it was anywhere, maybe Florida or Alabama, but this is an important hire, at least in part of the culture. I applaud the University of Texas. I'm stunned, and I am glad that the whole world is not as cynical about this as I would. Congratulations, Charlie Strong.
You know that I think that Texas is the number one program out there in college football, and I think that he has all the credentials in the world to have this job. He's a defensive coordinator at Florida for two national champions. His record at Louisville in 4 years is 37-15. It's 23-3 the last 2 years, and he's 3-1 in bowl games. So, even if you never saw a picture of him,
right,
this would be a hire that makes sense. You do hear, though, that he's not a backslapper. He's not a media guy in the way that Mack Brown and Darryl Royal were, and so people are saying it's not a good fit. My feeling is, if you win, it's a good fit.
Well, Tony, but to win,
more
he
mail.
May have to do things there and be involved with boosters and the community
That's right.
of Texas alums in a way that the Texas alums have never had to deal with before, and Charlie Strong has never had to deal with before, even though he's coached in the South. So I hope it's a good fit, but I don't know yet.
So Jim, I'm going to get you to weigh in here, then we're going to bring Greg back in. So listening to Wilbon speak there, it was a lot of substance in there, primarily his record. I mean, if you look at his record, I mean, what else do you need? If you have a winning record, you come from a program, and typically – most coaches don't come out of the gate being winners. They have to establish themselves over a period of time. Clearly, he's established himself over a period of time.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that was, you know, that was what caused some of the pushback from those in the sports world, was that if you look at his record and go by his record alone, and as the other host was saying, and you don't see his face, all you see is his resume, he's a daggum good coach. And when he was down assisting down in Florida, when Urban Meyer came in and took over Florida, he was the only coach that he retained from the previous coaching staff. So that says something, because as we're talking about Urban Meyer, we know what kind of championship was won down there. So that says something about the type of coach he is and the type of what Urban Meyer saw in him in terms of his ability, and he didn't want to change that on the defensive side. So, yes, I think the fact that his resume is what it is, and we don't always know everybody out there. You know, I didn't know who Lane Kiffin was before he went to Tennessee and then left them to go to USC. But, you know, I don't know every coach. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to take a look at their resume and give them a shot to see. But I think what caused some of the concern was the fact that his resume should speak for himself, and then let him go and try, because we've seen coaches with less stellar resumes not having winning records go and get some high profile gigs, and we question, well, how they get that job? Or we don't question it at all, because we know they know somebody. So, you know, it's a balancing act on both sides.
So, Greg, great point, Gene. So, Greg, when you hear this, when you look, clearly at his record, and when you see the programs he's been in, and McCollum says nothing about his record. He makes these assumptions. So man, what else conclusion can you come up with when it's definitely not based on his record?
I just think McCollum didn't think he was high profile enough. He's an unproven coach. I mean, I like the fact that they hired Charlie Strong. I like seeing the brothers. I wish the NFL was like the NBA. When a black coach gets hired or fired, it's no big deal, right? We don't even know how many, I don't even know how many black coaches are in the NBA right now anyway. And that's the way it should be. You get hired, you get fired, and you're married.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? But Charlie Strong, I mean, he was in Conference USA, I think that's where Louisville used to be at, Conference USA. You know, they're in, I think they're in the Big East now. I'm not sure where they're at now. But I don't know, man. I just think Texas, I'm going to give Red the doubt. I think they wanted a higher-profile coach, like an NFL coach, somebody that maybe – because I don't think Louisville is like a top-tier program. I think it's maybe a Tier 3 program, you know, Tier 2. I don't think it's a top program. I honestly don't think that McCollum thinks this man is ready for this Texas job. And all the pressure. And something else bugged me about Charlie Strong. His sideline, his sideline demeanor is not real professional. I saw him on the sideline. I don't know, he's ranting and raving and high-fiving. I just think, you know what, I'm not trying to be negative, but you know what, as a Division I coach, man, of a major program, you ought to be in control on the sideline. You know, not this rah-rah stuff. I just wish he would work on his demeanor a little bit, calm down a little bit, and act like a head coach, man. You know, because head coaches, say again.
What about Cliff Kingsbury at Texas Tech? Now I'm a Red Raider, and just to hear you talk about his demeanor, he's out there high fiving and slapping and jumping and kicking. I mean, so I don't hear people say that about him.
Let's be honest. Texas Tech is the third school in Texas, man. Come on now. Let's keep it. No, not even the second now.
Wait.
But the standard, though, the standard should be the same, right? No matter where he's playing. You said the third school in Texas, and that's still a top-tier program compared to University of Louisville.
Yeah, it is. But I don't know, man. That's why he probably is not going to get a top job unless he calms down like Saban or or Tony Dungy, you know, always. I mean, that's what they're looking for, man. They want them coaches to be calm, in control. They want them to be more presidential when you're out there, man. You know, like Lovie Smith. That's what they want. I guarantee you, if Lovie Smith would have got that job at University of Texas, Red McCollum wouldn't have said nothing. He'd been happy with that hire. Or Tony Dungy. You know, those professional coaches in control, checking their emotions. I mean, that stuff matters, man. It matters. I'm actually looking at coaches. Yeah, go ahead.
He didn't say any of that, though. He just said he was a second tier. A position coach. Come on, man, a position coach.
I know. You know what? That kind of bugged me. He's not a position coach. I mean, I would say offensive coordinator. I thought when he said position coach, I thought that was an insult straight up, and he went too far with that one. I mean, come on now. Position coach.
Exactly. So what do you make of his apology? He says, McCollum says, my interest in Longhorns Athletics and in the University of Texas was to see that we hire one of the best three coaches in the United States. I'm not sure I knew anything about the race issue until it was broadcast, like McCollum said. I didn't even think about that. He wanted me to help, one of my help and one of my support. I told him I would be happy to do that. But, again, I mean, when you make a statement like that, come on. I mean, he just – okay, so let's say it wasn't racist. Let's say it was a major insult, though.
I thought it was a low, tacky. I took it as an insult. I mean, a lot of people look at it as more of a race thing. I saw it as an insult, and I actually thought McCollum was sort of post-racial. I know this sounds crazy. I actually thought he was just pissed off, insulting the man, and I really don't think it was race related for some reason. I just don't. I just didn't take it that way.
You use a word. I need you to unpack this word a little bit more. Use a word called post-racial. Can you explain what that means?
Especially
coming from an 80-year-old man.
Huh?
Especially,
Well, people seem to think America is this colorblind society. Since we nominated Obama, there's no more racism in this country, and that we're past racism. A lot of people, I don't think we are. I think America's a very racist country. I'm 47. Of all the countries I've been into, I think America is probably the third most racist nation I've ever been in the world. And I'm a black man, but I honestly don't think race had to factor in this Charlie thing. I think he was looking at the man on his merits. And like I said earlier, I have ripped Lane Kiffin. We have ripped coaches. Why can't a white man rip a black coach? I mean, I think it's fair game here, you know?
Yeah. So I agree. I tend to lean on the side because the statements that he made were not race related, but I think they were very insulting to the head coach of your program. That is a discussion you have with your people in your circle. You have that discussion prior to coming out publicly and saying that. He disrespected the entire process and the University of Texas football program by making statements like that. You know, about the head coach. I think that was inappropriate and non-professional for him to come out and do that. That's just my take. Now, as far as the race is concerned, yeah, it could be debated either way. I could see both sides of the coin here, but it's definitely a significant impact to NCAA football for the University of Texas to hire an African-American coach. I think that's the bigger story here. Jimmy, what do you think?
I think that's the highest. Go ahead.
I agree. I think that is the bigger story, and I think it's important that we do put things in a proper perspective. I think, you know, it may not have – his intent may not have been to be racist, but I want to know the last time a white coach was hired at a major institution and somebody came out and said that that's a kick in the face to hire them, and I see them as a position coach. I just want to know when is the last time that happened. So
that happens every day.
I need some facts behind that. I'm saying that the statement that was made by that guy, that type of person, and I'm not talking about sports people. I'm talking about that type of person has that type of pull at that university, not media people, not just lay people in the barbershop, but a person has donated billions of dollars to an institution who had buildings named after him on their campus that has come out and said, this coach, hiring this coach is a kick in the face, and I see him as a positions coach or something else. I haven't heard that. I haven't heard that about anybody. So it may not have intended to be racial, but when you haven't heard it about any other race, you tend to wonder, was it? So you do have to question it. So we've had the question. The good thing about it is Charlie Strong, you know, felt like, you know, he didn't think it was. He said, he doesn't know me. I have to go in and prove myself, which is true. The best way to shut up people is to go in and win. So he has to go down there, kick off this season, and he got to come out the gate winning. He don't get one game. He doesn't get a game. His first game better be a victory, and it better be significant. I don't care who they're playing.
He's got 3 years minimum.
No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. They've already put the mark on him. I mean, I hear you, and that's rose colored, and that's the glass half full. But we are in Texas, and we're talking about the University of Texas, and we're talking about how they did Mac Brown at the end of his career. So they ready to win, and they ready to win now. So
Mac needs to go. Okay, about 3 years ago. Okay.
Although they're going to tell him he got 3 years, he knows he better win in year one.
He has 1 year.
And we know that.
No, he's got 3 years, man. They ain't going to fire the brother after 1 year. Come on. He's got about two or three years before they get rid of him.
He's going to be calling for his head, watch.
And Mac asks, you know what, Mac needs to go a long, long time ago. And you both know
But he didn't. He should have been gone a long time ago. But he didn't. So... you know, we can say what shoulda, coulda, woulda, but they got rid of him now and actually left on his own, I guess, kind of forced out the door. But, yeah, he should have been gone 3 years ago, but they didn't get rid of him 3 years ago.
They always give coaches 2 or 3 years to turn, you know, to get a program going. They give him 2 or 3 years because, for one, he has to bring in his own
recruits. Did Willingham get 3 years at Notre Dame?
No, he didn't get it at Washington either. He only got two years at Washington after he got fired from Notre Dame. So,
so you just
I just thought.
Exactly.
I didn't prove your point.
He has 1 year.
No, it's okay. Look, for one, they got to pay him all that money. They ain't going to pay his ass all that money plus pay Mack Brown for the rest of his deal and then pay Charlie Strong.
He got
a five-year deal, I think. He got 5 years, I think, Charlie Strong. They ain't going to pay him all that money.
I mean, they got him in a bargain. He was a discount.
How much they pay him?
$5 million a year for five
years.
That's
pretty good.
That's pretty, pretty yeah for University of Texas
said,
the most money
right,
in the
said,
NCAA
but,
they could have paid him three
times. But you just said at the beginning of your much money Texas makes, right? That they won most ranking whatever you said. So then
they
got the money to pay them.
They're actually number one.
Longhorn Network and they got all this TV money and stuff. So their bottom line gonna be their bottom line.
No, not really, because people don't realize college supports the whole athletic department. So you got people playing football, University of Texas Longhorns, they're actually supporting girl volleyball, water polo. They're supporting other programs in the athletic department. That money is not just – the money's not staying in Texas football. It's supporting track. It's supporting whatever, hockey. It's supporting soccer. That money supports other athletics in the department. So
yeah, at what cost? Yeah, I'm going to definitely agree with you there. Yeah. I think that's well documented. But the amount of revenue generated from football is probably 300 times what's produced in any other sport, and it's a fraction of the cost to run it. So, I mean, for example, the volleyball team, how much revenue you need to run a volleyball team?
They have to travel. Scholarships too, bro. They have to give scholarships to those girls on the volleyball teams and softball teams. So scholarships, man.
Okay, so let's say 1 year. Let's talk about what McCombs did. He donated $100 million. This has nothing to do with the revenue generated from the team. He donated $100 million. So they have money. They have more than
enough money.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to take a quick break. Greg, man, you are awesome. I love your perspective. Hope you stay with us after the break. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back. We're going to actually shift the conversation here a little bit to talk a little bit about what's happening with the Department of Justice and Department of Education as they begin to look into school discipline. We're going to hear from Arnie Duncan when we come back. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. We'll be back at
You are listening to Kind of Friends with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Gema, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Gema. And Ask Gema says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my equal.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy. Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full-service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We should focus now to a topic that's near and dear to my heart because of the amount of discipline that's impacting young people, especially young people of color, in the school systems around the world. Now, there was an article that was posted on the Department of Education website, and it reads, "The Department of Education, in collaboration with the United States Department of Justice, released a school discipline guidance package that will assist states, districts, and schools in developing practices and strategies to enhance school climate and ensure those policies and practices comply with federal law. Even though incidents of school violence have decreased overall, too many schools are still struggling to create positive, safe environments. Schools can improve safety by making sure that climates are welcoming and that responses to misbehavior are fair, non-discriminatory, and effective. Each year, a significant number of students miss class due to suspensions and expulsions, even for minority infractions of school rules. And students of color and with disabilities are disproportionately impacted. The guidance package provides resources for creating safe and positive school climates, which are essential for boosting students' academic success and closing achievement gaps." Now, I want you to hear from Artie Duncan himself on this particular issue. And then afterwards, we're going to kind of have a quick discussion around this issue. Take a listen.
I'm Artie Duncan, U.S. Secretary of Education. And our shared goal of preparing all students for college, careers, and civic life cannot be met without first creating the safe campuses and positive school climates where teaching and learning can actually thrive. Creating a safe school and a positive school climate can be tough, tough work, but no student and no teacher should ever feel unsafe or unable to concentrate on learning because of violence or disruptive behavior. Yet, even as we set high expectations for student behavior, we must also emphasize prevention and supportive approaches that keep students engaged in school and with learning. Today, too many students are unnecessarily removed from class each year due to suspensions, expulsions, and other exclusionary discipline practices. During the 2011 school year alone, more than 3 million public school students received out-of-school suspensions, and over 100,000 students were expelled, leading to our students losing hundreds of thousands of hours of instructional time. Youth of color and students with disabilities are far more likely to be removed from school for disciplinary reasons than other students, and African American students are over 3 times more likely than their white peers to be suspended or expelled, often for very similar offenses. Everyone understands that school leaders need to have effective policies in place to make their campuses safe havens where learning can actually flourish. Yet most exclusionary disciplinary actions are for nonviolent student behaviors, many of which once meant a phone call home. Suspending and expelling students for nonviolent behaviors comes at great cost to both students and their community.
So, Jima, let's get you to weigh in here. You have one of the most impressive resumes when dealing with young men and women in this particular field, right? And so I want you to kind of first start with your background and why I made that statement. And then secondly, I want you to respond to what's happening here and then in the school system and specifically how the U.S. Department of Education as well as the U.S. Department of Justice is responding to this behavior.
Well,
Okay. Well, I guess first, just my years of experience in working in juvenile justice, over 20 years now in working in the field of juvenile justice, working with juvenile offenders that have been adjudicated, found guilty by the court system for an array of crimes, some minor, some major. But I've seen the gamut in terms of kids and getting in trouble. And more importantly, though, I can say that of all the times that I've worked in institutions that I've worked in, there was not a week that went by that a parent in the community didn't call to ask for some help for their child. That they, you know, their child may have been getting in trouble in school or something was happening at school and they didn't feel as though they were being listened to by the school administration and they was wanting some help because they didn't want their child to end up in my institution. The unfortunate thing is that when it comes to prevention, true prevention, a lot of programs out there don't exist anymore. And so we really can't help that parent or there aren't a lot of services available to that parent or that child until they do get in trouble. And that's unfortunate. And so as we look forward to what the Department of Justice and what the Department of Education is trying to do, is that they're trying to put manage how we treat behaviors across the board. And if the study and the data is showing you that a African-American male and a white male both violate the same rule, and yet the black male is suspended at twice or three times the rate as a white male who does the exact same thing, that's discriminatory. You know, that's unfair treatment in the public place. And so that has to be addressed. And unfortunately, it's been going on for an extremely long period of time. When you look at different agencies and businesses out there that try to address the disparities of black and brown kids that are being incarcerated, being arrested, even just being arrested, the numbers are staggering as it relates to their white counterparts for the same infractions. And so I am thankful, grateful, just excited that the Department of Justice is taking a look at this to see how is this impacting what we've come to call our school-to-prison pipeline. What is it about what's happening in our schools that is a school infraction and not a violation of a law that has become part of a larger system that 9 times out of 10 feeds them into the adult prison system. And so it's high time that someone took a look at the data, because the data has been there for a long time. I've seen some of the pushback from some of the different places, Louisiana being one, which I'm really not sure how Governor Jindal can talk about anybody education when Louisiana education system is what it is, you know. So to try to say that this is race baiting and that they now have to treat African American students different than they treat the white students, well, you're already treating them different because you're already arresting them and suspending them and giving them all these major infractions at a higher rate that you're doing with your white students. So, yeah, I want you to treat them different. I want you to treat them the same way you treat everybody else. And so I'm thankful that this is where we're starting now, and that hopefully Attorney General Holder and Secretary Duncan will be able to push this thing forward, and even start schools that are willing to take a look at their own numbers and see what they've done. I mean, it's public record, what happens in those school districts is public record. And so, we ought to be able to gauge it for ourselves as to whether or not this is a real problem or a perceived problem.
That's an excellent point. I want to bring Greg back in on the line. Greg, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here. What's going on?
What do you think about this? The Department of Education and Department of Justice has said, hey, we have a problem here. And this is not an opinion. It's basically substantiated by years of data, and it was quite naturally presented by Arnie Duncan himself. So what do you think is happening here in our school systems? In particular, why these minorities and students with disability are being suspended and expelled at a higher rate than their white counterparts?
Well, I can answer, but you're not going to like my answer. So, sure you won't.
Oh, that's, I do want to hear it. Come on. I like your perspective. You definitely bring us perspective.
Okay. I think discipline, kid having a lack of discipline, I think that's a parental issue. I think schools are there to educate kids. Discipline, that's the parents. That's their responsibility, to discipline your kids and make sure they're disciplined. And that's what I think, okay? And as a black man, and I have black kids, I think the problem lies with our kids being undisciplined. And I know friends that are school teachers, and they hate to admit it, but most of their problems are with minority kids. That's where most of the problems are. Kids are disciplined. You know, they don't sit still. They talk back, and it's a serious, serious problem. With the teachers will tell you that if you get them one-on-one and talk to them, they will tell you. I have one of my good friends is a teacher, and she always says she has problems with the black kids. I give her more problems than any other kids.
Okay,
she always says that. Yeah,
let's assume that that's true, and. And I think that's debatable because I think my perception of one behavior may be different than someone else's perception of another behavior because of where I was brought up, right? For example, you know, if a child talks back, you know, in one home, it may be different from what another home may say the child is talking back. I mean, there's plenty of examples of that. But I want to try to take a look at something you said. And you said that there's a lack of disciplines by the parents, basically. Okay, so let's assume again that that's true. But the question, I guess, really that's at hand, if two kids, one black, one white, commit the exact same offense, the issue here is that they are expelling and suspending the minority kid at 2 to 3 times rate than the white kid. So the question I have for you is, even though we assume that what you said is true, lack of discipline, what's the explanation, though, for suspending and expelling kids at a higher rate for the same offense?
Okay, well, I'm going to say something else that people aren't going to like. I think a lot of black kids are cause most of these discipline problems, and I think they are suspending black kids at a much higher rate for the same offenses. You can find that in the criminal justice systems. For the same offenses that black men do or white men do, black men and black women will get far higher sentencing for the same exact crime. That has to do with racism. So we're dealing with two problems here. We're dealing with kids that are acting up, that are undisciplined, and we're dealing with a racist system, racist society that you know, that gives white kids the benefit of the doubt. So we're actually dealing with two problems. You know, and my father,
That's an excellent point.
And my father told me this when I was a little kid. I keep going referring back to that, man. But he always told me, man, that this system's not set up for us, man. I mean, it's not. They want to see black kids fail, and we're just playing along. We're doing exactly what they want us to do. Kids are undisciplined. They're crazy. They're out of control. And I see these kids, man, you know, they're out of control. They're nuts, a lot of them. And they're just playing along into this white racist society that wants to suspend them, put them in special ed, put them in remedial classes, say they have behavior problems. So we're actually dealing with two problems. We're dealing with a racist society, and we're dealing with undisciplined kids, which is a perfect recipe for what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, and I want to look at something, though. You mentioned...
Yeah.
The behavior. So the question becomes, I mean, well, let me ask you this. Do you believe that African-American kids are just bad because they're black, or do you believe that there's some other issue that's causing the behavior, right? I mean, there's a cause and an effect to almost every situation. So if the effect is them acting out, them, you know, talking back, what's the cause? What's the cause of this behavior?
I could answer it, but you're not going to like my answer. You sure you want to hear it?
Yep.
I think the cause, man, is single-parent households that are causing these kids to act a fool. Because I couldn't act a fool growing up. My pop would go upside my head, man, straight up. I mean, he would go upside my head if I acted crazy. And we got single-parent households raising these kids. These kids are out of control. There's no discipline in the home. Kids don't care. They get suspended. Their moms don't care. If I got suspended, my papa put me out. Tell me, get out of his house. Straight up, out. Get your ass out of here. There's no discipline in the home, and the kids do what they want. The kids are basically running the homes. You think these kids are out of control of school, they're basically running the homes, too. They're out of control at home. They're telling their moms what to do, cussing them out, not disobeying them. It's just a extension of what they're doing at home. And because of single-parent households, if you really want to go to the problem, that's the core of the problem, single-parent households.
You know, that's interesting, Jima, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, parents do call for help, right? They're saying, hey, you know, my child is doing this and my child is doing that, and they're not getting the help. So it sounds like there's a lot of validity to what Greg is saying. Do you agree, Jima?
Well, here's what I know, and here's what I know to be true. I know that we spend a lot of time dealing with the symptoms. We spend a lot of time on the behavior, and we don't spend enough time trying to figure out what's driving the behavior. I'm a firm believer that every behavior has a purpose, and whatever that purpose is, my goal is to get something out of that. I have a need that I'm trying to meet. So when I'm coming to school acting up, something else is going on in my world. Now, is it for the teacher to figure that out? Probably not. But since she's there, she needs to at least attempt. That's just the nature of the beast. Yes, I know. We put more on our teachers now than we ever have. I understand that. I have a huge heart for educators. I really do. I have a huge heart for those that work in the educational system, because on a daily basis, you are dealing with so many things. You're dealing with a kid who last night had no place to sleep and stayed at a friend's house, and they're hungry, so they come to your classroom unkempt. They may have an odor because they didn't have anywhere to wash up this morning. And so not only is their mind not right, they don't feel good about themselves. And so before you can attack me as a fellow student and start bullying me, name-calling, who you think, I'm going to go in and get you first. I'm just going to be put out of the classroom. So I don't have to deal with you. So we got that going on. We got situations where all things equal, black kid, white kid, both do the exact same thing. It's shown. That is proven. Our institutions are showing us, because the data is there as well, whether you're talking adult, as the caller mentioned, or you're talking juvenile, the data is there to show who's there. The number, the high number of minorities that are incarcerated is higher, period, across the board. And if you have a situation where all things considered equal, it might both be from single-parent homes, black and white, and they both commit the same infraction at school, data has shown that the black kid is going to get a more severe punishment than the white kid. Why is that? Back to what the caller said. At the end of the day, that's just pure racism. That you can't put a dress on that and call it anything other than what it is. And once we start calling things, Yala Van Zandt says all the time, call a thing a thing. Once you call something what it is, it forces you to address it and to deal with it. We put it on single parents. We put it on no discipline. We put it on a whole lot of things as to why things are happening. And sometimes it's just as simple as, I don't think you are of value. So because I don't think you are of value, I'm going to put you here. But I think you have potential because of how you look, or I know your family, or I know your family's just on hard times right now, so I'm going to put you here. So because of where I place my value on you is how I'm going to treat you, how I'm going to interact with you, how I'm going to judge you. And that's at the end of the day, that's what's happening. Our students are being judged not just by their aptitude, not just by their behavior, not just by their physical appearance or their personal appearance, but they're being judged through the lens of how I see you. And how I see you might be based on my own bias and my own prejudice about how I feel about you. And that could go both ways. I'm not just saying it's all white on black, because I'm pretty sure there are some black educators, some black teachers, some black people in charge that look at white kids and be like, I ain't gonna let you get away with jack just because I know you think you can't. So I'm going to ride you like a dirty shirt. So I know that happens. But the statistics are showing us that it happens more in the reverse than it does that way. And so we've got to do something about that to change that, because we're doing our kids a disservice when we spend more money locking kids up than we do educating them. If we spent the same amount of money educating our students and keeping them out of institutions that we did on making sure everybody's school had good books and the computer labs and music programs and all that sort of thing, then we would see a difference in the behavior in the school. But, you know, somebody has to be the one and that says what the elephant is in the room. And the elephant in the room right now is that the data is not lying. We didn't make up the numbers. These are hard numbers. We have the facts. Now what are we going to do with it?
So, you know, that's interesting. I want to kind of unpack two things. One thing that Greg said about single parents raising their kids, and the other thing, Jimmy, you said talking about the system and how the impact that it has on the family. And so there's a recent story out of Houston that I want you both to take a listen to, because it's all over social media right now. And it's really, it addresses both of those two issues. A, it addresses taking the father out of the home intentionally. And B, it addresses the system and how the system is stacked a certain way. So take a listen to this particular report, and it addresses those two exact same issues.
Well, a Houston father is facing 180 days in jail for overpaying his child support and overvisiting his 11-year-old son. His attorney and a community activist are now demanding answers. Randy Wallace joins us live with a story you'll see only on Fox. Randy?
Don, we all expect to see judges throw the book at fathers who failed to pay child support. But a father who says he's been doing the right thing now has an arrest warrant against him.
It's my responsibility to take care of him. You know, I brought him in this world. I have to.
Clifford Hall says he's more than happy to pay child support for his 11-year-old son.
I'm his father. You know, it's my responsibility to take care of it.
But Hall says when the amount of child support was modified, no one told him.
And I discovered that for some reason his employer was withholding a large amount some weeks, a small amount some weeks, zero amount some weeks.
And I didn't want to go to jail, basically.
So Hall quickly paid almost $3,000 in back child support. When Hall and his ex-wife were in Judge Lisa Millard's court last November, he owed nothing.
Opposing counsel testified twice that he's all paid up.
But the attorney representing the child's mother wanted Hall to pay her $3,000 in attorney fees, and Judge Millard agreed. Court documents also reveal Hall wasn't following the court's scheduled times to pick up his son, another modification he says he knew nothing about.
The judge ended up sentencing him to 6 months in jail.
When she said, remand you to the Harris County Jail for 180 days, my mouth just dropped.
This entire situation is shocking to me. I've never seen one like this.
Community activist Cornell X wants the state's judicial board to investigate.
The court failed the child. The court failed Mr. Hall. The system broke down.
I can't be there for my son in jail. I can't pay child support in jail. You know, this is not in the best interest of the child.
Judge Lisa Millard says Hall walked out of court after he was found in contempt, which she says is a big no-no. Judge Millard also points out Hall's attorney could have filed a motion for reconsideration. She says that would have allowed her to hear both sides again and reevaluate the situation. Hall's attorney is now working on an appeal, and in a few days, Hall plans to turn himself in, and Don will, of course, keep everybody posted on how this plays out.
It really is a strange.
Okay, so as you see, in short, this young man overpaid in child support because they kept changing the amount. So he just said, hey, you know, you said I didn't pay, so I'm going to pay these $3,000. And then the prosecution said, well, you don't owe anything. And then the second thing that happened is that they changed the visitation on his side to reduce or restrict the amount of times that he can see it. And they said that he was seeing the child too much. So here you have a case where, A, the system, as we talked about earlier, and the fact that the father is taken out of the home. So it kind of addresses both of those two issues. And so as a result, you have the behavior that we're seeing in school. Fathers not being at home to address what Greg talked about, and the systematic problem that systemic problem that we have in the school system. And Jimmy, what you address, Jimmy? So what do you say about that? That story.
I just say that's a sad case, and I had been reading about that as well on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot, and it's unfortunate. And you know, I kind of feel like, you know, this is why in some instances you have lawyers that get a bad rap, because the opposing attorney wanted him to pay for her legal fees that. He wasn't entitled. He didn't have to do that, I guess. But that's why I kept going back, you know, from hearing that statement about it, going back in front of this particular judge. And then you have to wonder, well, what was the judge thinking? If child support is supposed to be in the best interest of the child, and that this man is doing everything in the best interest of the child, he's paying child support, he's seeing his son. It's not like he's not around. He's being an involved parent. Sending him to jail does what? It doesn't. So whatever child support he had caught up on, now he's not going to have a job. Who knows if his job will take him back, when he gets out in 6 months. So he's just kind of like, you know, what was it all worth? And so that's why you can see both sides of, you know, men who don't want to get involved with the court system because it doesn't play out fair. And then in this situation, it just doesn't make any sense. None of this is adding up to make any sense. And so it's unfortunate, and I hope that something else is done before he has to report to Harris County, because that's just crazy on so many levels.
Yeah. So, Greg, what do you say about a story like that? Man is obviously trying to do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, for one, I heard he went to jail for contempt of court. But
the judge sentenced him to six months in jail. It had nothing to do with contempt of court.
Okay. Well, for one, man, I don't really watch the media. I kind of listen to half of what they say, because the media, to me, is like entertainment. You only get half the story because they play games. So anything out of the media, man, I just – you got to take it with a grain of salt, man. I think the media is just entertainment. I don't respect what they do. So I'm going to stay out of this one now.
Okay, good deal. All right, we're up against the top of the hour, and it's time for us to take a break. When we return, we're going to open up a conversation that has been taboo in the African-American community for a long time. And this is a segment that I call really the Shades of Black. And we're going to be talking about colorism. This was a life class that Oprah had, and it was a very good life class, and I watched it, and we're going to have a conversation about the Shades of Black. So we're up against the break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, Tailor Made Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my
stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook. Patrick Cook.
I'm Jean Cochran. Secretary of State John Kerry says continued negotiations with Iran represent the best chance for the world to ease fears about Tehran's nuclear program. He spoke in Paris today, where Iran and six world powers have agreed to begin implementation of their interim deal next week, freezing most of Tehran's nuclear program while talks continue.
For the first time in almost a decade, Iran's nuclear program will not be able to advance. In fact, parts of it will be rolled back.
And in exchange, Iran will be granted immediate, modest relief from international sanctions. Kerry says the U.S. will keep a close eye on Iran over the next 6 months as talks continue toward a final comprehensive agreement. Israelis are mourning the loss of General and former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today. There has been a constant stream of visitors to the Parliament building where his body lies in state, all walks of life, from political allies to citizens who only knew him as their leader to former Army colleagues such as Yuri Rotman.
My heart is broken. In Israel, he lost the King of David. There's no other word to describe this man than that. They don't make people like this anymore.
There will be a state memorial service tomorrow. Vice President Joe Biden will lead the U.S. delegation. Sharon died yesterday at age 85. Hundreds of students who supported Egypt's ousted president have been battling security forces today at the main university in Cairo. These clashes come 2 days before a planned vote on a draft constitution. Interim President Adli Mansour is urging voters to head to the polls on Tuesday and Wednesday. This draft charter, he says, uses moderate Islam as a basis for legislation. His military-backed interim government sees the vote as a big step toward legitimizing its removal of President Mohamed Morsi from office. The Taliban are claiming responsibility for a suicide bombing today in Afghanistan that killed two and wounded some 20 others. NPR's Sean Carberry is in Kabul.
A spokesman for the Kabul police says a suicide bomber rode a bicycle up to a bus full of police officers, cadets, and civilians. The detonation tore the bus open and knocked it across the street. Most of those injured by the explosion were police personnel on the bus, but half a dozen women and children in the area also suffered wounds in the blast. The Taliban have said they intend to carry out attacks throughout the winter in an effort to derail April's vote to elect a successor to President Hamid Karzai. In the last week, the militant group has carried out a number of deadly suicide attacks on NATO and Afghan government targets around the country. Sean Carberry, NPR News, Kabul.
This is NPR News. In West Virginia, deliveries of bottled water continue, and now meals ready to eat are reaching the thousands of people whose tap water's been polluted by a chemical spill. Dave Mistich of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
Director of Support Services for Kanawha County Emergency Ambulance Authority, Brent Berger, estimates his precinct has handed out water and MREs to roughly 10,000 residents of the county.
To this point, we've done about 800 missions.
Okay, and one mission may be 10, 15 different residents.
Berger says his precinct expects regular water supplies from FEMA to continue throughout the day and beyond. The ambulance service is focusing on getting the MREs to those who are elderly or have medical issues. For NPR News, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
The women's U.S. Olympic figure skating team has been announced in Boston. Asma Khalid of member station WBUR reports that it includes a two-time national champion who bungled her free skate at the U.S. championships there yesterday.
Typically, whoever wins gold, silver, and bronze at the U.S. figure skating championships competes in the Olympics. But Ashley Wagner, who finished fourth this year, has been chosen for the Olympic team, bumping the bronze medalist off. Here's Wagner, who fell twice during her free skate program.
You should not be defined by one bad performance. And for me, when I look back on my career, this one horrible performance isn't what makes me the skater that I am. That doesn't define me.
The other women chosen were Gracie Gold and Polina Edmonds. For NPR News, I'm Asma Khalid.
I'm Jean Cochran, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We now shift to a topic that that is taboo in many regards. And it's a topic that Oprah covered on her life class and entitled colorism. Now, colorism is a term that was coined by Alice Walker in 1982. It's not a synonym for racism. Race depends on multiple factors, including ancestry. Therefore, racial categorization does not solely rely on skin color. Skin color is one mechanism, only one mechanism, used to assign individuals to a racial category. But race is the set of beliefs and assumptions assigned to that category. Racism is dependent on social status, on the social meaning attached to race. Colorism is a dependence of social status, of skin color alone. And so the conversation that was taking place was in respect to this notion of light skin versus dark skin versus brown skin, not just in the African-American community, but also in Latin, Asian, Southeast Asia, East Asia, India, Latin America, and other places in the United States. So this notion exists across the board in many regards for people of color. It is just that in the African American community that it has taken on this broader notion, and because of slavery and other dynamics in the United States, it has some other connotations associated with it. So, but in respect to, with respect to colorism, the life class, Jima, I want you kind of weigh in and kind of set this up for the audience. The class, now that I've defined what colorism is, talk a little bit about the Oprah's life class and what happened there, and then we'll kind of talk about the topic.
So Oprah periodically has these life classes that she covers an array of topics, And most of the time, before you can watch them on television, you can actually be part of the live experience online. So you can actually catch it as they're filming it. And so you get all the things you don't get to see on the taped version that comes on TV, usually a couple of weeks or a month later.
Yes, I did.
I attended one that was down in Houston where she spoke with Joel Osteen. And Pastor Joel Osteen out of Houston, and so that was a unique experience. I thoroughly enjoyed myself there. So that's why whenever I can, I try to catch the live version. Because so you do get a little bit more information. You get some of the behind the scenes chatter that happens in the audience at the time that is all going on television. So that's the backstory of life class, and you generally can take notes and really kind of talk yourself through some things and really be a part of it. You can Skype in. You can send Facebook messages to the show as it's happening live. You can tweet messages, and your tweet might be read, or they might respond back to you. So it's really, really, really interactive when she's having these classes live. So I, you know, that's just a plug for me. So anyway, so this particular class this past Friday evening was on colorism, as you stated, and it talked about the difference between light skin and dark skin, and more specifically, light skin, dark skin women. This does tend to be more of a concern, or women tend to have more of an issue or deal with this on a more personal and a daily basis, more so than African-American men, I believe. So most of the people in the audience that had the feedback in the comments were women. And so it was Oprah, and it was Iyanla Van Zandt. She was the co-host with Oprah on this, talking with the different people and asking them different questions about how they felt about themselves. She brought up the documentary that Bill Duke did called Darkie, or Dark Girls. I think it was Dark Girls. And I watched that, too. I remember when that came out a couple of months ago. And so that was good. They talked about what used to be called the paper bag test back in the day, when a paper bag was basically held up to your face to see if you were lighter than or darker than the bag. If you were darker than, then you couldn't get into certain places. Some people in some places still have feelings around the paper bag contest or the paper bag test, shall I say. And so it just kind of talked about that, and it dealt with some of the people there in the audience who had their own real-life experiences, light and dark, and is it really about being lighter than? Is it really about being light-skinned, or is it about being lighter than? Because, as you know, we come in a whole array of shades. As it relates to people of African American descent, we have a large color spectrum there, and so and you have some that on either extreme, you're either too light or you're too dark, or you're not light enough to be part of the light crew, or you're not dark enough to be a part of the dark crew, and so we put all of these things or labels on ourselves. And that, as Iyanla stated, you know, it has a deep connection to slavery, and which is something else we don't like talking about. We want to act like slavery didn't exist, and more importantly, we want to act like slavery didn't have a major impact on our psyche. And this is just one instance in which it did.
You know, I want to peel the onion back a little bit about the issues you said. You mentioned having an impact on our psyche. And one thing Van Zandt said that struck me as kind of interesting, and she said that the most unacknowledged mental health crisis is this issue of colorism, meaning that if you have this self assessment of yourself because of the light-skinnedness or darkness, it is one of the most unacknowledged mental health crises that's going on in our society. What do you make of that statement?
I agree with that wholeheartedly, because we don't talk about it. Because somebody has told us we should get over it. And so if I haven't gotten over it and it's still a part of me and I'm being challenged by something daily, then I can't just get over it. So I agree. We don't talk about it. And in order for you to be able to deal with something, you have to acknowledge that it's a problem. And so this is one of these things that once you start to probably peel back the layers and the onion, as you say, and you're dealing with somebody, you probably would get to this. But on the surface, you're going to say, oh, a person just has low self-esteem. You're going to say a person just don't know how to connect with other people. You're going to say a person has boundary issues, or they lack social skills. You're going to come up with all these other things initially until you start to peel back the layers on the thing and begin to see it for what it is. But before you can do that to help the person themselves have to be able to call it what it is. And that doesn't happen that often either. Because nobody wants to, you know, be seen as a victim. And so we've been told that you know, to blame something or to equate something, you know, to say that colorism is a real issue, the real crisis, then, you know, it's like we're putting ourselves in a victim stance. And that's not true.
You also mentioned that it's a bigger issue for women than it is for men, but I want to kind of suggest that it is an issue for men, but in a different regard. And what I mean by that is in a lot of cases for women, it's color and it's really feelings and it's how one feels about themselves or feels about another person in related to her. But for men, it's really about competency. If you're an African-American male, in many instances, if you're dark-skinned, then you're considered to be a Mandingo type. You hear the phrase tall, dark, and handsome. And so there's a lot of positive connotations associated with African-American men when they're dark. But it's not always the case for African-American men that are what I would consider to be light-skinned in a lot of instances. And people joke about the fact that Wesley Snipes bought the dark-skinned brother back in the day with New Jack City and a couple of other roles that he played. But it still, in a lot of instances, has been brought in a negative light with respect to color. But when it comes to an African-American male in general, light-skinned or dark-skinned, his competency is in question. So I think that's a bigger deal for a man than it is to a woman when we talk about this color line, if you will. So I want to kind of get Greg to weigh in here. If Greg, are you still with us here?
Yeah, I was listening, man. It's an interesting topic.
And so do you think, with respect to colorism, when it comes to light skin versus dark skin men, do we have that same feeling that women have when they're talking about colorism?
No, I mean, my wife is light-skinned, very light-skinned, I'm sort of in the middle, and I've always gotten a little bit of flack from her family. I think they prefer if I was lighter skin.
Wow, that's interesting. How do you feel about that? I mean, the fact that people hold your color against you like that.
It's just, man, you know, as a black man that's medium skin or dark, whatever, I mean, that's something we've always dealt with, just this light skin, dark skin stuff. Even my own family, my father was dark, my mother was light. So some of my brothers are light, some of us are dark, some of us in the middle. It started when I was probably in school. My little sister is light skinned, and I'm sort of in the middle. And they didn't think we were brothers and sisters because she was light skinned, and I was a little bit darker. And so I grew up with that as a 7-year-old, 8-year-old. And now it's, you know, I've dated sisters, and my wife is light-skinned, and you know how it is, man. Those light-skinned sisters, they're the one that seems to have the issues, man, with this color. I don't think men care that much. I think it's more of a woman thing. They seem to be on this light-skinned stuff, man, for some reason.
I think we're saying exactly the same thing. It's really an issue for women in general when you're talking about light skin and dark skin because of there's a kind of an assumption if you're lighter, you're going to get treated better. If you're lighter, you know, guys are going to gravitate towards you. You're going to get more privilege. And it was so much the case years ago that they didn't allow certain women, you know, this is what the paper bag test was. Is that if I hold a paper bag test up against you and you were darker than the paper bag, then you were not allowed in certain places. And if you were lighter than the paper bag. Yeah.
Yep,
that's true. And so Jima, so your perspective as a woman, you kind of heard the male perspective, and it really doesn't bother us that much. What's the female perspective, not just what they said on the show, but from your experience dealing with this issue?
Well, fortunately for myself, I've never had I've never experienced that in terms of either being too light or too dark or in the middle somewhere. I've never had anyone where if they did mistreat me, I didn't know it had to do with my skin tone as much as the fact that I was just black. You know, in some situations, it's just because you're black, whether you light or dark, the discrimination comes because of the color of your skin in general. And so that's been my experience. But I do have friends who have come to me in tears because they have been shunned by their peers. I mean, even if you go back to Spike Lee's school days, and you go back to the light-skinned girls that was in one sorority and the darker-skinned girls in another sorority, what was that all about? And the names that we call one another, High Yella, Jigaboo, Darkie, Coon, all these negative references when it comes to color. And so what is, you know, where did that come from, and why have we allowed it to just stay so active and have such such power in how we deal with one another? So I've seen both sides. I've seen, you know, the really pretty dark girl say she's pretty to be dark. I've heard that to say it to friends of mine, you know, or, man, if she wasn't so dark, I would. I've heard, you know, the dark-skinned sister say about the light-skinned, he just with her because she, you know, she light and damn near white, you know, so you get that. And so, you know, so that person, I mean, so they get it from all sides, you know, and it's unfortunate that we've allowed it to play, but you even go to hair. I mean, it's not, you know, historically, so people will have told us, like, if you're lighter skin, you had a better grade of hair, whatever that means. If you're darker skin, you had a more coarse, kinky hair. And so we wanted to have the flowing hair because that meant more that you were more beautiful. And so we've allowed ourselves to be defined, our beauty to be defined by somebody else's definition of us. And at some point, you know, we've got to take the reins from that and not subject ourselves to those sort of standards and say we come in an array of colors and every last one of them is beautiful. And, you know, but it's hard to hear when you've been outcast or when you've been shunned or when you've been put aside or when you've been shamed or when you've been dropped because of you're darker than or lighter than. So it's real. It really, I really wish it was make-believe and that these people just had a few issues. But the stuff that we're talking about is real. It happens on a daily basis.
Yeah. You know, Ayanna Van Zandt said during the colorism life class that, and you mentioned it just then, about shamed. And a lot of the shame comes from years and years of slavery. And so I think a lot of people really discount the impact, especially the psychological impact that it has on African-American race. And so when you look at the grand scheme of things, being from 16, 1900, even before that, until basically 1965, African-Americans were not considered people. And so we get these rights in 1965, and you can just tell, I mean, within a 50 to 60-year period is really when we begin to kind of discover our rights and who we are as a people. And so if you're in a society that beats you up, you know, physically, literally, for centuries, you know, for centuries, and then you come out of this notion, and now everything you know to be pretty, every word associated with beauty and cleanliness and excitement has to do with white, and everything has to do, any derogatory term has to do with black, and, you know, black market and black male and, you know, dark, and so the stark terms that we use associated with the African-American race, then it's no wonder that the psychological impact that this particular thing has had on our life as a people. So you put that in context of what happened over those years, and then you couple that with the fact that during the slavery period, you had what they call inside people, and you had outside people. And so you create this system where they're already against each other. And you mentioned the other day, last time we had a conversation about Samuel's character in Django. You had a brother like that was always, you know, on master's side, and then, you know, putting people against his own people. And so now, you know, here we are, you know, not so many years removed from slavery. It's no wonder that we still have this type of impact on our society. And so when we talk about this issue of shame, Jima, what do you think the shame, how it's being dealt with by our people?
Well, I don't think it is being dealt with initially because we, as I stated earlier, we cover it up and say it's about something else. And so we don't say that it's about you're too dark or you're light or you're not whatever enough. We say it's self-esteem. Oh, we just tell you to love yourself. But we don't give you enough instructions on what we mean by that. By that, we mean every part of you is special because nobody else's DNA is made up like yours. Everything about you is unique, from the freckle on your nose to the curl of your hair, even when you straighten it. That's unique to you. And we don't spend enough time talking about our uniqueness because we're such a world of followers now and everybody is doing what everybody else is doing. So we don't spend enough time talking about those sorts of things. And so because of that, it's stuffed down and it's stuffed down and it's stuffed down. And then it doesn't come up or it doesn't come out or it comes out in so many different ways. So it goes back to, you know, if I'm being teased at school about being too dark or called names at school because of, you know, whatever, you know, is happening in class or whatever, then I'm acting out about that. But all you see me is acting out. And so you never ask me what's going on. And if you do ask me what's going on, you're not going to really take the time to investigate that because that's an uncomfortable topic. It's uncomfortable to talk about race as much as it is uncomfortable to talk about skin color. So those two things are almost, you know, taboo to even discuss. And so we don't spend enough time really telling the young girl, I mean, the young lady that was on there, that just broke my heart. I mean, nothing, she could not see herself as being pretty, beautiful, gorgeous, inviting, sexy, none of that, because she's dark. And to her, dark is evil. Dark is bad. Dark doesn't mean anything. Dark doesn't have any real power. Dark people don't like dark people, so I shouldn't like myself. So that's all she's hearing. Although she had all these other people tell her so many other things, she couldn't tell her to herself. And until she's able to tell it to herself, it's not going to matter what everybody else tells her, because she's still going to walk in that shame. She's still going to walk in, I'm nothing. I'm nobody. Nobody sees me because I'm too dark to be seen. And
you know,
that's unfortunate. It's sad.
I'm glad you brought that up because this is an interesting book by John Bradshaw called Healing the Shame That Binds You. And it was one of the New York Times bestsellers. In chapter 2, he talks about the sources of toxic shame. And he says the family system. He said toxic shame is primarily fostered in significant relationships. If you do not value someone, it's hard to imagine being shamed by what he says or does. The possibility of toxic shame begins with our source relationships. If our primary caregivers are shame-based, they will act shameless and pass their toxic shame on to us. There's no way to teach self-value if one does not value oneself. Toxic shame is multi-generational. It is passed from one generation to the next. Shame-based people find other shame-based people and get married. As a couple, each carried the shame from his or her own family system. Their marriage would be grounded in their shame core. You know, I bring that up because we talked about the system of slavery and the fact that there's been, you know, many moons that we've had this shame really passed down, and it's substantiated here by Bradshaw's work talking about the source of it. And so when you mention this young girl who has obviously just been devastated by someone that was really core to her relationship or core-wise, then we can see that it really matters what parents say to their children and how they need to foster positive relationships in order for them not to feel, you know, that type of shame. So for her, in this particular instance with the colorism, this young lady feeling the shame, it's sad to see it in that way because really it's at her core. And unless someone from her core relationship that helped build that in her, it's going to be hard-pressed for someone else to get it out of her. What do you think?
I agree with that. I agree with that. And it may be so stuffed down deep inside of her that she suppressed it, that she doesn't even know where it started. And that's the most unfortunate thing is that we have these traumas that have happened in our lives that we've blacked out and blocked out to protect ourselves from the feelings that come along with the trauma. And so whoever or whatever, whoever and how many of them did it to her, you know, they've really done a number on her. And you know, listening to her will take years of therapy to get her to see her value. Because as long as she feels as though she's ugly and not worthy, she will never, ever, ever consider herself to be valuable. And she will always consider herself to be second tier and less than or an afterthought. And when you put that out in the atmosphere, that's exactly how people are going to treat you. And see, and I can speak to that from a weight perspective as well. I never allowed my weight to deter me from doing anything I wanted to do. It never held me back from doing anything. So whenever I walked into a room, if I was the largest person in there, I didn't bother me because I knew that I was supposed to be in the room and that I was not defined by my weight, but by my knowledge, by what I knew in my head, by what I was ready to teach you because you didn't know something. And so the same thing with my skin color. When I walk into a room, the first thing people see if you don't have a bio, is that here's this black female coming in here. That's the first thing you see. Then you figure out how old I am. And then I become the youngest person sometimes in the room. So I'm young, I'm black, and I'm a female. And yet I walk in the room with confidence that I'm supposed to be there. If I am at all jaded about my skin color, about my gender, about my age, about my weight, then I will show that, and then you will begin to treat me a certain way based on how I am exhibiting my behavior to you. And so until this young lady begins to embrace herself and embrace her color and the beauty of it, she will always be treated as second class because that's how she treats herself. No one's going to treat her better because she doesn't treat herself better. And she's not going to put herself in a position to be treated better because she doesn't feel as though she deserves it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you in a lot of ways. But I must ask the question, in a lot of cases, we are not born with that. You know, somebody has to pour that into us, either the negativity or the positivity in us. So obviously you had to have some positive influence that gave you that confidence that allow you to behave in that way. So what was it then, because you grew up in the same type of environment that everyone else, you're African-American, you're a woman, and you grew up in an area where, in America, so obviously you have the same influences that most of us have. So what was it about your experience that allowed you or enabled you to behave in such a very positive manner?
Well, I'm the youngest of seven. And I was the biggest out of my family. I was bigger than all my sisters and even my brothers, actually. And so I was always teased as a child, always, always, always teased about my weight, but even by my family. But they were family, and that's just what they did because they teased me. But anybody outside of the house that tried to tease me, well, they got dealt with by my family. So although my family would tease me, they wouldn't let nobody else tease me. So that's how I figured, oh, okay, this is what y'all do, but can anybody else do that? Okay, cool. But as related to being a woman and feeling confident in my gender, I often tell the story that I never had a male teacher until I was in the seventh grade. So all of my formative years, which are the most critical in a child's development of who they are and what they can accomplish, I had female teachers. All of my teachers were women from kindergarten up until sixth grade. And I had one white teacher, my kindergarten teacher, Miss Barb, loved her to death. All my other teachers were either black, and I had one Hispanic teacher, but they were all female, all of them. So I had no idea that women were supposed to have a certain role, be at home, although my mom was a stay-at-home mom. My mom didn't start working until I went to school all day. And then that's when she went back and got her degree and did all that sort of thing. But prior to that, my mom was at home during the day. So I saw both sides. I saw a stay-at-home mom raise 7 kids. And then I saw my teachers that I figured, well, they got some degrees in education for them to be teaching me. So, this seems like I could go either way and I'd be okay. So that's kind of, I was just never told I couldn't do something. The expectation in my neighborhood, in my community, was that you will do. It was never what you couldn't do. Oh, you will go to school, you will finish, you will do well. You know, mediocrity was not accepted in my house. And it wasn't accepted for me. Being the youngest, I had to do better than what my older siblings did. At least that's what I thought. And that may have been something I put on myself unnecessarily, but I didn't just, you know, want to, I always wanted to be number one. I always wanted to be the great, the one that sold the most, the one that was the valedictorian, the one that everybody liked. You know, I always tried out for parts in the play because I thought I could act, I thought I could sing. So I never had a problem with it because that's just how I grew up. Walking into rooms as an adult with that history behind me and knowing my history, not just my own personal history, but my cultural history of the women that have made profound impact on society. You know, that you're not going to be able to tell me that there's something I can't do because I know I can, and I will, and then I'm going to show you, you know, when I get done how I did it. So it's just a part of who I am. I've never had an issue with self-esteem. Some will say I'm conceited. I often say I'm just convinced of what I know to be true. So because I know I can do it. And then the part, the second piece of that, is that I think because I had such a strong spiritual base as well that reminded me that, you know, there's something out here greater than you that would propel you to where you need to go. And so I looked for that. And as I got older, I began to rely on that more than on myself. And so that makes up the totality of GEMA. So I just never had to, and even when people did say things about me at school, talk about my teeth because I needed braces for a long time and we just could never afford them. And so my teeth was jacked up and people would make fun of that. But I was always quick-witted. I always would come right back. But my teeth didn't define me. You know, that was just a part of who I was and I accepted, yeah, my teeth jacked up. Now what? I still scored higher than you on a math test. I mean, you know, that's where I was. You know, so it didn't bother me. But I don't think it bothered me because I had such a solid family foundation. Because we all teased each other about our flaws, and we all knew we had them. See, I never thought I was perfect. So for you to call me out on something, it didn't bother me because I knew I wasn't perfect. And I think that had to go back. That goes back to my spiritual base. You know, there was only one perfect man, and I was not him. So because I knew that, you know, what you had to say to me or what you had to say about me didn't take me to any dark places because I knew something, you know, greater was there as well.
So you, a couple of things I want to kind of unpack a little bit is that the fact that the strong family structure coupled with the strong spiritual foundation at least gave you a foundation to stand on when you were faced with these traumatic experiences. And the other thing is that when you talk about your family doing it, but anybody outside of that doing it was a no-no. And so I feel the same way when it comes into African-American culture, is that if we was to get our house in order, meaning that we was to take care of each other inside, meaning that we should stop calling each other names, stop calling each other the N-word, stop looking at our color on the outside and worry more about our character on the inside, then we can begin to make really hold people accountable, like when you hear McCombs talk about make an insulting comment to a Charlie Strong. But it's very hard to do that when we're doing it to ourselves over and over and over again. That doesn't give them permission to do that, But it certainly doesn't help our case when it happens. When somebody else calls us a name, when somebody else treats us a certain way, you know, it really doesn't help our case when we do it to ourselves worse than they do. So for to call somebody by their name, outside of their name, to not support each other, to look at somebody light-skinned differently than you look at somebody dark-skinned, the fact of the matter is we all African-Americans living in America, we all have that same struggle. You know, I just gave two earlier examples when this young African-American male was doing more than what people would normally do when it comes to child support. He was paying, he was overpaying. He was over-visiting his child, but yet and still the system, you know, put him in, you know, sentenced him to 6 months, you know, for some crazy reason in my estimation. And so when you have a situation where you have the first, in 2014, we're still looking at first blacks. You know, the first black University of Texas. So we have our problems in as African-Americans in America, but that doesn't mean we need to continue to shoot each other down, literally and figuratively, you know, with respect to our skin color. So it's interesting as we move into the era of, you know, more African-American being in better prominent position, the president being one, and there are going to be others to come. As we start to clean our own house before we can start holding other people accountable for what they say and do to us as a nation, as an African-American in a nation. So I want to ask another question, though, and then I want to kind of wrap this segment up. Is this really about a person's economic status? You know, does a person's economic status, have an impact on the light-skinned, dark-skinned thing? And I say that in the context of a person like a Michael Jackson, when he clearly has millions and billions of dollars, his dollars even have dollars. And when he goes out and changes his skin color, for whatever reason people may say, how does that impact, you know, the African-American race at large? Because if he's doing it, he's trying to be that color. You know, what's wrong with his original color that he has to do that?
Well, I'm going to say that he may have thought something was wrong with his original color. He may have been teased beyond measure for that, and he just never really dealt with that. But although he changed through the course of time from one color to another, what he was true to was his humanitarian efforts for all people, and especially people of color. So he didn't completely turn his back on his race. He just wanted to be closer like somebody else, I guess. So I guess in that aspect of it, you know, it's kind of like, you know, half and half on the Michael Jacksons of the world, because the majority of us are not going to be able to go and change our skin. It's just not going to happen. Are we going to end up trying to bleach our skin and we're going to cause more harm than good and going to look even more crazy after we get done doing that? I mean, I think there was a lady on there that talked about her mom used to bathe her in bleach when she was little because she wanted her to be lighter skinned. And so, you know, all of those sorts of things just goes back to the parent who themselves was probably mistreated or shunned or shamed about their skin color. And so we often say you can't give what you don't have. I can't teach you something that I've never been taught. I can't teach you to love yourself regardless of how you look. If I have never learned to love myself, regardless of how I look, I'm not going to be able to teach you that. You know, I can only go to a certain level in mathematics with my son, and then somebody else is going to have to do that because I'm not going to be able to go any higher than what I know. And so it's the same thing, you know, in life. You know, I can only give you what I have and what I know. Other than that, I'm going to have to refer you out, and hopefully and prayerfully you'll find someone that will be able to take you to the next level. But so many times we don't refer ourselves out because, you know, that's mental health and nobody wants to be labeled as crazy, but some of us need some medication. And this kind of goes back to a question, the segment earlier with the caller about the difference in discipline with black and brown children as it relates and white children, is that, you know, sometimes those kids get referred for mental health services, white kids do. Black kids get referred to the principal's office and be in trouble. So, you know, that's where it starts. And so if they both have mental health issues, why are we only treating one and not the other? And why are we only treating one for behavior conduct disorder as opposed to some other mental health issue that might be going on? And so all of those things play out, and they play out every day. And so it's not just dealing with whether you're black or someone calls you a particular color, or you're not okay with where you fall at on the spectrum. It also has to do, you talk about economics of it. I don't think it has anything to do with it, because I know rich people who wish they was another color, and I know poor people who wish they was another color, and then I know rich people that are perfectly happy with who they are, and the same with poor people. So I think it's just what you've been taught. I think it's just your mindset. I think it's what you value. And that just plays out across all socioeconomic spectrum.
Yes, indeed. So I want to kind of wrap this segment up, and I want to kind of shift focus now to I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't cover what was happening with Chris Christie. You know, we only have a few minutes left, so so I want to get your opinion on what's going on with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. And let me give you what the latest is coming out of basically out of Washington. There's an article out of New York from the New York Daily News that says Chris Christie's career will be over if he's lying about Bridgegate involvement. And this is just a remark by Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Embattled New Jersey Governor Chris Christie can kiss his career and his White House dreams goodbye if he's lying about not being personally involved in the burgeoning Bridgegate scandal, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani said Sunday. He's held a press conference. He's flatly denied it, Giuliani said Sunday. This week of Christie's assertion, he did not know at least two of his top confidants had conspired to wreak havoc on the George Washington Bridge. If for some reason Christie's denial is not true, the man has put his political career completely at risk. Do you believe that, Jima?
What? He's put his political career at risk?
If he's lying, yes.
Yes, I do believe so. But, you know, America is funny. We have we have very limited long-term memory. 2016 is a long time away. The only way this story stays topical is if people in the media keep it topical and they remind us of what he did or what he allowed to happen on his watch. And he would have to make a lot of changes in how he interacts with people, because he comes off as this tough and gruff and it's my way or the highway, no pun intended, type of person. And so some people, you know, gravitate towards that. Some people think that's a great attitude to have. But when you're in a position of leadership, you've got to know, lack of a better word here, how to bridge between people. And so he doesn't always come off as someone that knows how to do that, except for when it's for his convenience. And so I think as more information comes out, I honestly hope that the woman that he has completely thrown under the bus stands up for herself and don't take this, you know, lying down and let him get away with just throwing her out there like that. I wonder if it was a man, if he would have been so quickly to fire him like he did her and talk about in such a manner like he did her. So there's a lot of issues here. And we can't allow him to just get away with, I didn't know. Because if you didn't, you should have. And when you found out about it, you should have stopped it. You're the governor. So you find out they're doing a study on one of the busiest bridges in the country, and you don't do nothing to stop it for 3 days, that's a problem. Because you could have said, do this later.
Okay, so obviously I got to give you an A-plus on the bridge puns. You know, they were pretty good, to say the least. Okay, so I want to kind of dig a little bit deeper on this issue with him not knowing. Specifically, when we're talking about the people that were closest to him, A, and then B, if this is the company that he keeps, meaning these are the people that he confides in, these are the people that he picks, and this is the character that they portray And there's a lot of people that say birds of a feather flock together. Then what does this say about him as the individual?
Well, it should say something about him. I mean, you know, we'll try to downplay it, like, you know, he has this rogue operative that just went off on her own, and that's just not how he runs his camp. But I think what you're going to find is as time and this story continues to develop, you will find that that was the type of atmosphere he ran in his administration. So it's going to come out. It's all going to come out, and it's going to come out in bits and pieces. You know, somebody might hold the story to the bitter end, but, you know, and try to get them through midterm elections and not really talk nothing else about it. But it's going to come out. And what needs to happen is that, you know, if he's talking about everybody needs to be held accountable, then he needs to stick to that and change where he needs to make changes and make adjustments where he needs to make adjustments as it relates to his leadership style.
Okay, all right. That's our segment for the day, show for the day. So what are your final thoughts before we close out today?
My final thoughts is that we have a lot of work to do on a community level for what we stand for, what we believe in. We have a lot of work to do with our children. We need to be holding our elected officials accountable. We need to show up at our school board meetings to find out what is there, what are the guidelines for discipline actions against students. We need to look research the data in our own community and see what, you know, where our communities fall, where our school districts fall, what's going down with Department of Justice and Department of Education. We need to continue to have people enrolled in the Affordable Care Act. It is there for us. And you just need to continue to gather information and make it applicable to your life. And more importantly, we need to tell ourselves on a daily basis that we are valuable, that we are loved, that I am appreciated, I am wanted. If by no one, I'm wanted by myself. You know, I often say I don't mind being by myself because I like me. And so because I like me, I can sit in the room with me. And so we need to encourage people to start liking themselves, for who they are with all their imperfections and all their flaws, whether it's straight hair or curly hair or kinky hair, coarse hair, it doesn't matter. Whether it's light or dark, just be who you are. Just like you, love you, embrace you. And for the person in your life that tells you constantly what you can't do or has something negative to say about you at all times, they probably don't need to be in your life, even if that's a parent. As soon as you can, find a way to break free from that negativity, because it's not, as you get older, it's not going to be any easier to walk away from it and to deal with it. So I just encourage us to take better care of ourselves on so many different levels.
All right. That's our show for today. I would like to give a special thanks to Greg for tuning in. He definitely added some color to the show today. And of course, a special thanks to my co-host, Jima Hill Cook. Now, you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJima. That's AskJema. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for business. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog, and that's at tailormadetalkradio.blogspot.com. That's TAILORMADE, Talk Radio, all one word, .blogspot.com. Until next time, remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer. Take us away, Joyce.